I think the main reason you all are here is to see the castle. And we have a resident expert who works with a navigator. She's a production supervisor for Nav Press, and he's one of the men that's responsible for this magazine. He's a graduate of the University of Wisconsin in journalism, and Gary Fisher now will come share with you about the castle, and when he's finished, then you'll be directed on your tours. Gary?
Good evening. I'm glad to see you here tonight so that you can enjoy this place with us, enjoy some of the history of it, and hopefully enjoy an evening of hospitality. I think Glen Eyrie has had a tradition of hospitality ever since day one, and I hope that continued tonight and you've enjoyed yourselves. You know that statue downtown that makes it hard to make a left-hand turn when you're coming west on Platte Avenue on Nevada there? It's a guy on a horse kind of serenely looking across Acacia Park at the people going into Jose Muldoon's. That's the man who started all this, General William Jackson Palmer. And a friend of mine asked me once, he said, I heard once that, you know, these statues you see, if the horse has all 4 feet on the ground, it means that the officer on the statue probably didn't do much during his career. If he has 1 foot up, he did okay. And if the horse is reared up, it means that he died in battle. And he said that makes me wonder about Palmer, because that statue downtown, the horse is just kind of standing there. Now, I wouldn't want a man's horse to ruin his reputation, because Palmer did have a very excellent record in his military career. And he began that career at the age of 23 with the outbreak of the Civil War. Now, in those days, the Civil War days, it was a little easier in the Army. They didn't often mess around with the draft and the lottery and all that. And if you wanted to, you could form your own troop. And then the officers were voted for. So Palmer formed a troop when the Civil War broke out and was elected a captain, which isn't a bad place to start. But he didn't fool around once he got in the Army. And one of the first missions he volunteered for was a spy mission behind Confederate lines. And on that mission, he was captured. And he would have probably been strung up by his captors, except that they couldn't prove that he was in the military. So he was spared that time. And in fact, he was promoted once he got back behind his own lines to the rank of colonel. And as a colonel, he was given command of the 15th Pennsylvania Regiment, a cavalry unit of 1,200 men. And it was there that he began to distinguish himself in several battles, so that by the time the war ended, he was promoted to the rank of general, even though he was only 29 years old, which makes him the second youngest general in U.S. history, right behind Custer. He didn't stay in the Army after that. He resigned his position because he wanted to get back to the career he had begun before the Civil War broke out, and that was a career in railroading. His first position after his time in the service was as Secretary of the Kansas Pacific, and his first responsibility there was to survey lines from about Missouri all the way to the West Coast, and he did that with several men, surveyed 4,000 miles of railroad lines, and eventually completed all those lines to the west under his leadership. And as you might imagine, he became a little bored after he completed those lines and was looking for a new challenge. So he looked around to fulfill a dream that he always had, and that was to own his own railroad. And he did that. He founded the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad, and with his vision, he saw that a regular railroad just wouldn't make it in the Pikes Peak region. So he built a narrow gauge railroad. His rails were only 3 feet apart. Standard gauges are wider apart, and they just couldn't negotiate the passes in the mountains in this region. If you're ever out in Durango, out west of here, you'll see some of the engines that Palmer started with, and you can ride that railroad back up into the mountains to Silverton. And that is a narrow gauge railroad. And I think if you ever take that run, you'll see what I mean. Because rather than building up on the cliffs to get back up into Silverton, they went down into the canyons right next to the river. And at places went through very narrow straits in order to get through the mountains. On that tour west, surveying lines for the Kansas and Pacific, Palmer laid eyes on a little valley at the foot of Pike's Peak, the place we are tonight. And it was then that he vowed to build his home there someday. So now that he was established in the Denver and Rio Grande in his own business, he went ahead and did that, fulfilled his dream, and built his first home here in Glen Eyrie, which was a wooden structure, much the same as the castle is today, but not quite as elaborate. About that time, his wife, Queen, was forced to move back east because she had a heart condition that was aggravated by the altitude, and the doctors recommended a lower altitude. And it was soon after she moved east that she died at the age of 44. That was in 1894. Then, it wasn't until 9 years later, about 1903, that Palmer went ahead building the castle as we know it today. Who knows what motivated him to build a 65-room English Tudor castle in the middle of the West? It isn't clear to us. He was 68 years old at the time, and maybe feeling a little extravagant. Or maybe he just wanted his daughters to enjoy the lifestyle that they had become accustomed to while they lived several years in England. It's unclear what his motivation was, but there is a castle here today. And we find in it embodied a lot of Palmer's character. That's why we discussed him first, because to get to know this place, you really have to get to know the man who created it. And we see here in the castle his ability to lead, to organize, to engineer something, and we see his ingenuity. He envisioned a castle from the start that looked old. So to start with, he went down to Bear Creek Canyon in the Broadmoor area and quarried his stones there, all of them having lichen on the face or having a weathered face so that they would look old as soon as they were put in the building. And any stone that was marred on the front by the masons would have to be rejected. It wouldn't make it into the building. And to cap off that old look, he went to England and imported a tile roof off a cathedral that was, of course, already old. And with the stones and the tiles, he wrapped each one in cotton, then put it in a barrel of sawdust for transport here to the building site so that it would not be broken or those stones would not be marred at all. He built the place on solid bedrock so that when the navigators moved in almost 50 years after Palmer built the place, we could obtain a Class A hotel license. The place was still that solid. And even today, you'll find very few cracks in the outside walls. He put 24 fireplaces in his castle and imported all but three of those from England. One that was not imported is behind me here. It's Indiana limestone. To get all the smoke from all those fireplaces out of the glen so that it would not just hang over the valley, he constructed a tunnel system with a fan that would draw the smoke down to a central place and then carry it through the tunnels and expel it out smokestacks on the ridges around the glen here. And there was a lot of smoke generated by his power plant. He built his own power plant here in the Glen so that the same year they turned on electric lights in New York, he could do it here at Glen Eyrie. His plumbing was pretty unique, and we're still using that plumbing today. He used brass pipes with a lot of nickel in them so that they didn't rust. And when we moved in, all we did is turn on the water. Later tonight, you'll have coffee in what once was Palmer's game room. He had several bowling alleys down there and a couple pool tables, some of the first pool tables that Brunswick ever made. Now, I know you ladies aren't too interested in plumbing and electricity and all that, and you want to know about all the conveniences out here. Well, if you had lived out here at that time, you could have been waited on by anywhere from 50 to 150 servants. It varied at different times here on the Glen. The servants would have been uniformed in uniforms that were reflective of their duties here on the Glen. And they were of all nationalities and even included a florist that would every day arrange flowers to bring up to the castle. Now, you might be thinking that, well, if I was out here, I wouldn't be calling those servants. I'd probably be one of them. And you would have enjoyed things like a central vacuum system, an electric plate warmer just outside the kitchen to keep the food warm, and quite a few other conveniences in the kitchen that we kind of expect today, but weren't all that expected back then, but they were here in the castle. Servants could be called anywhere in the castle by the general's annunciator system. He could push a button, and a flag would drop in the servants' quarters to show the servant where the button was pushed and where his services were needed. The general only enjoyed this place as a healthy man for about 4 years. He had a riding accident in 1906 that left him paralyzed from the neck down. Even though he was an accomplished horseman, he was on a borrowed horse that was nervous and skittish, and the horse stumbled and threw the general over its neck, and he landed on his head and severely injured his spine. But even then, as an invalid, his character came through. He's continued to have elaborate parties out here at the Glen, Christmas parties that he would bring out all the children of the city for. Even through a big party as the last reunion for the cavalry unit, 280 men here at the Glen, some put up at the Antlers Hotel. The general paid for them to come from all over the country, and they enjoyed a week here at the Glen of plays and the theater and concerts. Then in 1909, he died at the age of 71. And from that point, the castle went through several owners and was even vacant for a while. And then it was in 1938 that a man named George Strake purchased the castle. Strake was a businessman who made his fortune in oil and was a very active Catholic layman. And in that role became familiar with the Billy Graham Crusades and saw the effect of the Crusades on some of his friends. So when he heard that Graham was interested in purchasing the Glen, he dropped his asking price of $500,000 to $300,000. Now, Dawson Trotman, the founder of the Navigators, was a very close friend of Billy Graham's. And Graham and Trotman planned to purchase the Glen together to have as a conference center and a training center and headquarters for both organizations together. But a little while after he began the process to purchase the Glen, Graham decided not to go through with it. He decided that it was not part of what he was going to put his efforts into, and he turned to Trotman to say he thought the Navigators should go ahead and purchase the property alone as their own headquarters. Now, to do that, Trotman and his organization would have to raise $100,000 in 6 weeks to get into the contract. Now, as Rod already said tonight, back then, that was a year's operating capital, $100,000, and we needed that in 6 weeks. A couple of businessmen approached Trotman and said, "It's impossible. Don't even try, because in 6 weeks, you'll hardly be able to get your forces together." But part of what I think motivated Trotman to go through with it was that he had a vision beyond what those businessmen had, and he had a vision to see the bigness of God, the bigness of God and the capability of God in a situation like that. So he went ahead, and at the end of 6 weeks, there was $108,000 ready to put on the contract. The last 8,000 came in at the wire, and Trotman was ready to refuse it. But the person giving it said, go ahead and take it. It just might come in handy. And it did. It covered the closing costs and insurance at the signing of the contract. So the story of this place goes back quite a few years to a man named Palmer, a man with vision and character who went ahead and did things that others didn't. And for the Navigators, it ended with a man with vision who decided to go ahead with something difficult, who saw the bigness of God and saw God come through. And we're glad that we can share this place with you.